Hello and welcome to Talking Capital. I'm Ian Barnard, CEO of CapGen. Each month, I'm joined by a member of our investment team or a guest from one of the investors in our universe to talk about the investment themes and opportunities that are available today to family investors. What is CapGen? We're a private investment office for families with capital. Our clients are sophisticated, internationally minded investors, and what we do is to help them make the most of their capital and to seek out investment opportunities across any asset class in any region of the world. So in the course of these episodes, you can expect us to cover a globally diversified portfolio of assets and sectors, be that bricks and mortar or derivatives. In summary then, this is a podcast where we discuss the questions that we think are playing on the minds of sophisticated long-term investors. If that sounds up your street, do please subscribe and you'll enjoy a new episode published on the first Thursday of each month. Welcome to Talking Capital and to the first episode in the next short series. Over the course of the next three episodes, we're going to be moving away from private markets and turning instead to emerging market equities, what the opportunity set is, how to address manager selection in the sector, and then looking at a specific strategy with an active emerging market manager. As always, with the first of these three episodes, I'm joined by our CIO, Robert Sears, who's going to set the scene for us and start the conversation going and give portfolio context before we zoom in on a member of our research team and then finally to the investment manager, in this case, himself. Maybe to kick off, Robert, we perhaps need to give it a little bit of context and big picture. I wonder if you could talk to us about what's been going on with EM so far this year, because it has been a bit of a big year, hasn't it?
Yeah, so I think we talked about emerging markets before on some of the earlier episodes of Talking Capital, and we'll get to sort of where we think we are in terms of the cycle. But clearly, this year has been a good year for emerging markets. So if we're looking at 2025 performance, definitely outperforming. I think the good news, so I suppose that's good news for us and the portfolio so far, but the good news for everybody in the future is it's still very early days. If we're right about the direction, the length of the cycle, emerging markets does tend to move in quite long cycles linked to the dollar and linked to commodity prices. And we've had a decade of really underperformance by emerging markets. So it's in the context of long-term, 10 years of underperformance. This year, perhaps the start of some better performance. So I think that gives a bit of the context. And I think more broadly, when we're talking about emerging markets, today we're going to focus on equity. But when we talk about it and think about it, I think the three key asset classes that you can look at for investors really and that can drive returns are the currencies. And that can be exposure through your equities or bonds, but currency risk at different points in time can look positive or negative. Looking at the bond part, you can allocate to emerging market bonds. That can give you some credit risk and duration risk and can also look appealing. And then finally, the most risky of the lot, the equity component. And I think some of the trends which we'll talk on really potentially can help all three. So there is the tailwind of emerging market currencies starting cheap and potentially benefiting from that weaker dollar, which has really been the story of this year. Emerging market bonds benefiting from both the currency and also the fact that the emerging markets themselves are a bit more resilient. And then finally, which has been sort of supercharged, again, equity markets, which benefit from the cheaper starting valuations.
And I suppose, in a way, Robert, you perhaps put them in, maybe I'll make this a question and say, is it fair to say that's also in a way often of the order in which things go? So, you know, when there's an adjustment, it's typically the currency that moves first, and then it's the local currency assets that then adjust in price. And so, as you say, there has been something of a move in the currency, but the productive asset classes behind that, the fixed income and the equities, the cycles there can last very much longer. The currency tends to go first. Is that fair? Or
I think historically in emerging markets, again, things are changing, which is one of the themes we'll get to, but we've often had actually currency and the assets move together. So when the emerging markets come into favor, liquidity, capital moves in that direction, it's a buoyant time for the economy, and you just suck in capital. So you tend to have both currencies going up and assets going up at the same time. But on the bad side, the risk side, is you can have these runs on emerging markets when both parts go down at the same time. So a run on the currency and a run on the assets as liquidity is withdrawn. So historically, they've tended to move more together. That's not always the case. And I think what's interesting now, why it's potentially one of these bigger cyclical changes, is you do start with both pretty cheap at the same time. So the direction of actually they can both move in the same direction over a sustained period is one of the attractions for the short term.
Okay, Robert, that's helpful. Thank you. But as you mentioned, we're going to focus particularly on EM equities, and your broader point is, let's not forget there are EM currencies and there's EM debt, both hard currency and local currency, that are, you know, asset classes with an EM tab, but we're going to focus on EM equities. So zooming in a bit, Robert, can you do a little bit of boundary? You know, what do we mean when we talk about EM? What countries get in? What countries aren't included? Are all created equal, or are some emerging markets more attractive, more emerging, less emerging than others? What's that sort of taxonomy look like?
I mean, with everything, the less fine your classification, the more different things get lumped together. And emerging markets have certainly been more like that. It started off as quite a small part of the global economy, and it was based on the stage of development. So looking at countries which are less economically developed and have their capital markets at an earlier stage of development. So the countries with lower income, less development, and then they need to move up to developed markets to industrialize, become more industrialized economies with higher income, has generally been the sort of taxonomy. So in a way, things are changing because the world is developing, which is good news. So I think overall now, when we look at it today, if we look at MSCI as one classification you can make, about 87% of the market cap is developed markets. And so emerging markets is about 13%. The three core regions being Asia, dominated by China, which is about 30% of the overall EM, Latin America, and then EMEA. So Europe, Middle East, and Africa being the other chunk. So those are broadly the areas. There is this finer classification of sort of, if you're even earlier in terms of development, you can be frontier markets. That can blend a little bit. And even the developed emerging markets can blend. An example being South Korea is counted as a developed market by FTSE, but an emerging market by MSCI, based on its openness to capital, the fact that its equity market is not super open to external investors. But when it sounds like that, it's a decent chunk and it's an important bit to consider. I think the interesting thing is that development is supercharged faster than market cap. So when we look in terms of GDP, it's about 40 to 45% of GDP, depending on whether you measure it in purchasing power parity in terms of dollar terms or PPP terms. So that's a much bigger chunk of global growth. And then in terms of population, 85% of the world's population is in those emerging markets. So again, we can see the difference, which is one of the reasons with investors considering this, potentially you might be looking to structurally overweight emerging markets. Now, there is the cyclical decision, is it now a good time or not to go in? But certainly that's the basis of it being an important and growing importance in terms of the global economy.
And that, I suppose, before we dive into portfolio context of wrapping up the sort of big picture, that perhaps those stats capture the big long-term background to this asset class, in the sense that it is the countries that currently sit in that EM category do contain a huge share of global population, and generally in the very, very long run, economic activity and growth will correlate to some extent with population, because catch up economic growth and productivity growth and all that sort of thing. So that is, now you point out, Robert, that there's cyclicality within that, and we know that the long run can be very, very long run in these big moves, but at its heart that is an important part of it, isn't it? That just is these large, there is this big move, this is a large part of the global population, this is a large and growing part of economic activity, and it's just not really reflected in the size of their equity capital markets. And that's not necessarily because the equity capital markets aren't rightly valued. It can just be that a lot of the productive capacity of those economies is held in government hands or held in private hands, and that the values there just hasn't reached the public markets. But that is the broad big picture tailwind, isn't it?
Yeah, I think if you were to say, well, what's the reason to invest in emerging markets? The number one sort of reason to why buy the beta, why buy the market component of it is it's a higher growth area. And as you say, growth, people think of, well, we've got the demographics is destiny, so we've got growing population there. But also that shift in development can lead to a re-rating. So going from a lesser developed to a more developed economy can lead to significant catch-up economic growth. Now, the slight problem is, I suppose, when we come to risk, middle-income trap, countries have not always made that jump in one go. And also the other aspect of growth is innovation. Is innovation going to be in emerging markets, which is an important question. But in terms of sort of structural growth, why emerging markets? It could be a higher growth area because of those reasons we've talked about. And importantly, we come to that sweet spot of when the population, that growing population, moves to the middle class with greater urbanization and growth of the middle class, you see a burst of need for infrastructure spending, consumption, financialization of the economy. So those are the core areas, sort of infrastructure investments, consumer spending, and looking at the financial sector can be really interesting areas for the emerging market sort of rationale of why you want to invest in the area. I suppose the other aspect, as we said, diversification, it should grow a bit differently. That's been one thing in the past. They were very much idiosyncratic and you benefited your portfolio. I think as we move more towards the structural benefits, diversification is still there, but it's much less than it used to be because it being closer in terms of development, a lot of the countries are more closely tied to the Chinese cycle as much as the US cycle. I think those are the core business cycles. They become attuned. So you can't rest too much on benefits of diversification, but definitely those structural growth importancy alongside the cyclical, which is that sort of the why now element to it. Those structural reasons are why maybe on a 10-year horizon it's looked good. And you could have made a lot of those arguments in the last 10 years. But I suppose why is the why now, why does the cyclical attach to the structural is also the other important element.
That takes us neatly, Robert, into okay, how does all this fit into a portfolio? And you've sort of hinted at, I guess, two components. One is, you know, drivers of return. These are equity securities. There's a lot of underlying growth behind them. But at the same time, okay, what does it do for your overall risk? You know, are they uncorrelated? Are they not uncorrelated? So can you just talk a bit more about that, Robert, in terms of a portfolio? How much do you have in a portfolio? Is it a constant number? Is it a number that you should be seeking to grow steadily year by year? How do you think about them as a sub-asset class or an asset class in a portfolio?
So I think in terms of the beta element, the starting point clearly is that market cap, that sort of 13% if you were just to buy the market. I think the argument from those structural themes we talked about, particularly the emerging market consumption theme, is one reason, and the fact you're sort of underweight economic growth of the future, that's one reason to potentially have your neutral weight being over that through the whole cycle. So having a bit more emerging markets than maybe market cap. I think emerging markets, unfortunately, is a cyclical, for good or bad, is quite cyclical. So the cyclical component is really important. And that's important in terms of managing risk and in terms of getting your timing right. Because these cycles can last 5 to 10 years, as we've seen. 2000 to 2007, great period for emerging markets. 2010-ish, 7 to 10 to today, emerging markets have massively underperformed. So you want to get those long, decade-long sort of timings right, because those structural themes have been evident all the way along, but it's not been a time to be in emerging markets. So I suppose, why is that structural matching the cyclical today? Why would you go overweight and move your weighting up? Well, I think we talked about the dollar. Those cycles of when emerging market does well and does badly is very closely tied because of that link of the currency. Actually, the attractiveness of emerging markets is linked to those big periods when the dollar does well or does badly. And we've been talking about this regime shift to a period of dollar weakness over a number of years. And we're potentially in that period now. So there are the reasons why the dollar starts overvalued and some of the more fundamental factors based on the US current account deficit and trade deficit and some of the geopolitical risk that we've talked about before, that that other regions are potentially trying to diversify away from the dollar. So a period of weaker dollar is a period when emerging market does well. So, and that was the case of those cycles we talked about. So that's one reason why now might be the time. I think the second reason is thinking about the commodity cycle. So again, the region, the sectors you get exposed to in the emerging markets are a bit different. They are more tilted towards the areas of that early stage development growth, some of the areas I talked about before. But that's also tied to their big commodity producers. Think of Latin America as a core producer of lots of different commodities for the rest of the world in particular, and the demand from China for commodities. So the commodity cycle is really important. Again, if we're entering into a world where of higher inflation and real assets which have been out of favor come into favor, that's a world where emerging markets tend to do well. Now, it's not all that, because now we are seeing more innovation in emerging markets. So that's an element of how things have changed. But I think the third component, linked to the first two, is when you have these big capital flow liquidity cycles coming in and out of favor. So you do need to see capital flow into emerging markets for them to do well as well. So I think we're seeing those elements that are pointing to the direction of why now might be a more interesting time to increase emerging markets. Now, the other part, this sort of structural shift, is really China. Now, just as the US dominates the developed market indices, China dominates the emerging market. So your decision on what you do about China is, and how the Chinese growth is going to be in the coming years, is super important now. So really, in some ways, you can view emerging markets as the growth. Think about where China's demand for commodities and growth, and also US demand for some regions, but US financing conditions are super important as well. So those are the two of the key drivers. But we have seen a bit of a change, and one change is there's much more trade between emerging markets than there used to be in the past. So that linkage is breaking up. As part of that broader theme of multipolar world, we are seeing this sort of fragmentation. So the trade from that consumption, the benefits might not flow to the developed markets as much as they used to. So there's a lot more emerging market champions are going to capture that growth. And so that's another reason why it's going to be a bit more different this time round, and why you do need some exposure to emerging markets. And also, in a multipolar world, there is very much the US sphere, the Chinese sphere, and countries in between. And you can't forget, they could potentially benefit from playing off one region against another. Now, there are some risks to that strategy, but so far, the benefits have been more positive. I think India is a classic example of benefiting from cheap Russian commodities. Now, that's coming to a crux of the political risk of maybe they're going to have to take a decision one way or another from US sanctions, but that remains an opportunity set. So I think there are these differences, these changes. But having said that about growth, I think it's important to mention not all growth translates to financial returns, as we talked about, as you mentioned before, Ian. Emerging markets for ages have grown much faster, but the performance of financial assets hasn't been as good over the whole cycle. And one of the reasons for that is, as you mentioned, private assets capturing a lot of the growth. I think rent seeking has been another big part of and corruption. And lastly, just share issuance. Share issuance fuels a lot of that that growth in market cap. So you do need to be somewhat careful. But even having said that, those cyclical reasons are one of the main areas of sort of why now in terms of buying the beta of the market.
Can we just touch on the fragility question? So I think, you know, there's both in aggregate and there's at the individual level. These are just more fragile countries, and that's about where they are in their state of development. More fragile politically and more fragile economically. Maybe China you take out because it has reached such a scale now. It is perhaps less fragile. But what's in the news at the moment? What's in the news at the moment is Argentina. It's just persistently fragile. And clearly the political and the economic fragility intersect with one another, because, you know, you become politically fragile if the economy is malfunctioning and vice versa. And there are blow-ups. Take the 1990s. It was just a whole series of emerging market crises. We had Mexico, and then we had Thailand, and then we had Southeast Asia, and then we had the Russian default and denouement. So the crisis, although they're idiosyncratic, when they start out, they can, or they have, not they can in the future, they have historically sort of cascaded. So how do you deal with that fragility question, both at the level of the individual economy and also what historically has been something of a contagion risk?
I think firstly, it's acknowledging it, as you say. So there's a higher potential return, although it's not always been delivered, but there's definitely more risk. So earlier stage development, you can benefit from the jump in growth, but there is more political risk. There's more regulatory risk. Changes can be abrupt and with little reason. Although you might catch a theme to this in a minute, there's less institutional stability. So again, is there monetary policy going to be held firmly or is there going to be political interference? There's less financial stability. There can be the imposition of capital controls. So there's currency risk and your capital can get stuck. They're less liquid markets, particularly, as you say, in a crisis. So it can work. The liquidity flows in one direction, but it also flows out at the same time. And yes, there can be capital controls which completely stick your money. But even just trying to get out, the market just suddenly, liquidity dries up just when you need it, just when you want to exit. And there have been these periods of contagion, in the late 90s, the Asian crisis, Russian default. So there's lots of examples in the past. And they will continue into the future. Now, the only thing I would say is developing means things are getting better. So in a way, there was a lot of risk in terms of the balance sheets of those Asian countries before those crisis periods. The balance sheets are actually much better for the country. The levels of debt are much more sustainable. Monetary policy is actually much better than it used to be. There's been a buildup of a lot of institutional development, particularly in the more developed of those emerging markets. So the fundamentals have changed. We can't just group it and think things are going to stay the same forever. Having said that, even though China completely looks like a developed market in many ways, one would argue actually it's quite a fragile economy and system. When you do have the Communist Party rule that they do have, things can stay stable most of the time and suddenly there can be a big abrupt event. So that risk hasn't gone away and we shouldn't forget it. So how do you protect yourself? It's from sizing and diversification, I think, and being active, I think would be three of the things. Now, what I was hinting at early slightly is things have changed and a lot of emerging markets look better than they did in the past. A lot of developed markets now look a bit more emerging market. So a lot of the things we're talking about actually hold sway with many parts of the developed world, including the US. So institutional stability is not a given for the future for everywhere that it's fixed in one position. Rule of law can come and it can go. So yes, those risks are more in emerging markets, but the gap, the differential is probably less than it's been in the past. The risk is just more everywhere. So I think that's crucial. Now, I said you might want to go active. I think that's also, so we've talked about lots of the opportunities for why the market looks interesting, a lot of the risks of why the market's risky, but actually there is the alpha opportunity as well.
Well, that's it. Sorry, just to interject, I think in a way that's where I'd like to sort of take the conversation now, because I think, you know, you've set out the longer term opportunity, you've touched on the why now, the intersection of the structural and the cyclical, the fact that it's not just emerging markets that are on the move, but it's developed markets that are on the move, not always in a positive direction. You've got in the background this cycle of the dollar, and which has clearly been on a long run up, and you know, maybe now's the moment when it comes down. How to get the exposure? So the world's on the move. We've all seen how indexing and ETFs has taken an ever larger share of investment capital, and we now have active ETFs where you get sort of investment management packaged, relatively systematic investment managed, packaged in an exchange traded, easy to access, easy to trade, easy to get out of instrument. So can you take us through, and you've given your answer, which is go active, but I wonder if you could talk us through why that is the right answer and why we shouldn't just, you know, save a whole bunch of cost and complexity and just, you know, go and buy an ETF.
Well, I think it's active completely. So we use a bit of both. There is some at times you want to be active in some areas. So there's, I think a mixture of active and passive can work. But why is active? Potentially, we talked about the risk side. You can reduce risk, but also a big part of why you want to go in emerging markets, because a lot of that growth does dissipate. Yes, they're faster growing, but if you just buy the passive index, you actually end up with much lower returns than you've had in the past. Historically, buying developed market companies that give you exposure to emerging market growth has been a better way to generate returns. But that's not necessarily going to be the case going forwards. And what is the reason why emerging markets give you that sort of alpha opportunity, the opportunity to add, reduce risk and benefit from stock picking? Well, they're just more inefficient markets. They're less covered. So the research isn't as good. The people you're competing against is not as good. There's not as much capital chasing after these names. There could be markets dominated by local and retail flow. I mean, even Korea, massive retail flow in that market, which again, retail flow can be opportunities to take advantage of. So a priori, when we're looking at markets, emerging markets could be an area where being active could make a lot of sense. So there are times you might want to be passive, there are regions you might want to be passive, but definitely there's the opportunity. However, having said that, and you'll hear that in our next call, our research team, when we've been looking as an investment team trying to crack this, it's been really hard to find good active managers in emerging markets. And there have been different ways to look at it. Do you want a pan emerging market exposure or do you want to have regional exposures? And it's gone in and out of favor. I think the important point is those risks we talked about, being cognizant of the macro is important and it remains important for emerging markets. Not only when do you want to be overweight emerging markets, but which regions, where's political risk brewing, and things can change quite quickly. So again, that's a reason why potentially you want to have some flexibility to move and make those decisions in terms of countries and political risk exposure. Now, some of that can be done through your choice of areas, but often the emerging market, those classifications they talked about earlier, they're quite small parts of a portfolio. So unless you've got a big region like India or China, it's quite hard to make meaningful exposure changes between the different regions. So I think this is one of the reasons why when we've looked at it, you want to be active and have some ability for the manager to make those movements and be macro aware. I think the other point and the other reason why you want to be a bit more active than the ETF, there can be concentration risk brewing, which I think has been there with China. It's less so than in the past, but it's still a big part of the exposure. The other aspect is you really need to think about quality of business. How do you protect yourself against those emerging market just endemic risk? Is you want to be in quality businesses that are going to protect you against those risks of corruption and political change. They need to be a bit tied into the region, but they also need to be quality international businesses. So I think you need to weight your exposure accordingly. And I think that's what we've tried to do. So I think when you're looking at it, I think broadly, having an active manager with some of those ability to move. If you're using passive, be cognizant of some of those big decisions. So the timing is important when you over underweight, but also do we have China or not in our exposure is one of the key positions to make, particularly given the level of risk in the market. So I think that's one of the key aspects and sort of how we're going about approaching it, having that blend of active exposure with enough levers to pull to protect you, but also take advantage. And importantly, while macro is still important, I think having a sectoral view, so being a bottom-up stock picker is also important because as much as everything is regional and country-based, we're actually moving towards a world where understanding sectoral developments is just as important. And I think that's that ability for the stock picker to see the telecom sector, the banking sector, and be able to take a view across countries is as important now in terms of just having a regional exposure and saying we want some LATAM exposure today. I think those sectoral viewpoints are another important lever. So that's another reason why potentially you want to balance your exposure with a good active manager. Although, as I should say, and we'll hear the travails of that, it's been a very hard region to the ability to get it right gives big returns, but actually it's been really hard to get it right for allocators. Finding those good managers has been quite a tough task.
Well, thank you very much. That's a perfect point to end because that leads us effortlessly into the next episode, as you say, which will be talking to a member of the research team who has been in charge of turning this hypothesis into, okay, what is the active manager we can buy? So, Robert, thank you very much indeed. And thank you for joining us. Bye-bye. A link to CapGen's privacy notice and full terms can be found in this podcast summary description and on our website.
Thank you.